Chapter 4, Intelligence Basics, Knowns and Unknowns. Seek the truth and speak the truth. That's our mission. Daniel Coates, Director of National Intelligence, 2017 to 2019. This was it. Decision time. On April 28, 2011, President Obama gathered his top foreign policy advisors in the White House Situation Room. After months of meetings so secret that not even the Secretary of Homeland Security or FBI director knew about them, Obama was about to make one of the most consequential decisions of his presidency: whether to greenlight a Navy SEAL team raid to capture or kill a man the CIA believed might be Osama bin Laden. For months, a small circle of intelligence officials had been watching a man they called the Pacer inside his walled compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, a city 35 miles north of Islamabad. While the CIA thought he might be the infamous al-Qaeda leader, they were far from sure. There had been no direct sighting, no DNA evidence, no eavesdropped phone call to or from him, no intercepted email, no human source who had come forward and said, "I saw him, he's there." All they had was circumstantial evidence. The Pakistani compound was very unusual, more like an expensive fortress than a house, with high perimeter walls topped by barbed wire. Even the second floor balcony had a 7-foot-tall privacy wall. There was no internet connection or telephone landline, and the residents who lived there burned all their trash. Three families lived inside, but none of the children went to school. The owner, who was listed in property records, lived in a guest house, not the nicest part of the main residence. And the Pacer never ventured outside the compound. Ever. He just walked around the vegetable garden, back and forth, underneath a tarp. Satellite imagery never captured a picture of his face, but analysis of his height based on his gait and the shadows he cast during his garden walks suggested the Pacer could be tall, anywhere from 5 feet 8 to 6 feet 8. Bin Laden was thought to be 6'4". What happened next is now well known. President Obama authorized the CIA covert operation to raid the compound with a Navy SEAL team. Osama bin Laden was killed, his identity confirmed, and his body buried at sea. Commandos retrieved an enormous stash of the terrorist leader's papers and computer files. The covert operation did not stay covert for long. Within hours, President Obama went on television and announced, "Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children." The bin Laden raid is a thrilling story and an intelligence success, but it's also a rare chance to see how intelligence actually works. What exactly led to that fateful meeting in the White House Situation Room? What constituted intelligence, and how was it collected? Why was it so hard for analysts to find bin Laden, and how did they finally succeed after 10 years of searching? And why did the president choose a CIA covert operation to kill bin Laden rather than a larger overt military strike? This chapter seeks to lift the veil on this secret world by examining intelligence basics through three lenses: an analytic lens, a human lens, and an operational lens. Without the intelligence community's unique sense-making mission, its people, and its capabilities, operations like the bin Laden raid couldn't exist. We start by laying out what intelligence is and is not. Next, we look at the human dimension of intelligence through personal reflections of current and former intelligence officials, whose careers included briefing the president, catching traitors, handling defectors, and writing the first report warning about the threat posed by an obscure Saudi millionaire named Osama bin Laden. Finally, we revisit the bin Laden operation to see the three core missions of the U.S. intelligence community in action: intelligence collection, intelligence analysis, and covert action. an analytic lens, what intelligence is and is not. Put most simply, intelligence is information that gives policymakers an advantage over their adversaries. We've come a long way from ancient days when gathering intelligence meant divining the will of the gods rather than understanding the intentions and capabilities of humans. In the 5th century BCE, Chinese general Sun Tzu was one of the first to realize what now seems obvious: better information makes for better decisions. Rather than consulting oracles, interpreting dreams, and reading portents from animal entrails, Sun Tzu suggested gathering real data to outwit adversaries. If you know the enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles, he wrote. Knowledge never guarantees perfect decisions, but it does reduce uncertainty, which makes better decisions more likely. In the case of the bin Laden raid, intelligence was successfully used to kill the mastermind of 9/11. But it would be a mistake to think of intelligence only as a tool that supports violence. Intelligence plays a crucial role in every aspect of statecraft and every kind of decision, from diplomacy to trade, coercion to cooperation. A tank commander under fire has to know whether the bridge up ahead will collapse if crossed. A diplomat needs to know whether the Iranians are adhering to or cheating on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The national security advisor has to get a handle on what the cyber threat landscape looks like and how it's changing as she develops a new government-wide cyber strategy. The president, seeing an opportunity to negotiate a multinational free trade agreement in the Asia-Pacific, needs to anticipate how China might react. At its essence, intelligence is information that helps policymakers. Intelligence is understanding knowns and unknowns. In his February 12, 2002 press briefing, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld described the limits of intelligence in the Iraq War when he famously started talking about known knowns and unknown unknowns. Critics had a field day. Some thought it was a gaffe. Others called it convoluted thinking. Some even set his comments to music. Here's what he said. Reports that say that something hasn't happened are always interesting to me, because as we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know. We don't know. And if one looks throughout the history of our country and other free countries, it is that latter category that tends to be the difficult ones. Rumsfeld wasn't rambling. He was popularizing ideas that intelligence officials had been writing about for years. Sherman Kent, a Yale history professor and the founding father of the CIA's analytic branch, distinguished between three types of information in a 1964 essay. First, there are indisputable facts, what Rumsfeld referred to as known knowns. These are questions with definitive answers that U.S. intelligence officials have found. For example, whether China has an aircraft carrier is a knowable fact, and it is known by U.S. intelligence agencies. China's first aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, was purchased from Ukraine in 1998. Kent described a second type of information as things which are knowable but happen to be unknown to us, or what Rumsfeld called the known unknowns. How exactly does the Liaoning maneuver at sea under various conditions? That information exists, but it requires firsthand knowledge on board the ship over long stretches of time. Chinese sailors know it, but U.S. intelligence agencies may not. Kent called the third type of information things which are not known to anyone, or Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns. These are things that are simply not knowable. How long, for example, will the Chinese Communist Party remain in power? Not even Chinese leader Xi Jinping has the answer. Leaders' intentions often fall into the unknown unknown category, too, because they are not clear even to the leaders themselves. Getting inside someone's head is actually difficult, even for them. To To see why, consider the following vacation prediction exercise I give my Stanford students. On a piece of paper, write down what you plan to do for your next vacation. Now imagine that we reconvene in a year and compare what you wrote down to what you actually did. How many of you might do something different, and why? At this point in class, hands shoot up. Many admit they probably won't end up doing what they planned because they haven't made the decision yet. Over time, events happen and preferences change. Students might get a job or lose a job, meet a boyfriend or break up with one, discover a new passion, or suffer a family emergency. They come up with dozens of reasons why their plans probably won't pan out as they expect. That's you predicting you, I remind them. It's the best case intelligence scenario. Nobody can predict your intentions better than you can. Next, I ask them to imagine predicting the vacation plans of the student sitting next to them. That's so much harder, someone usually says. Finally, I ask them to imagine what it would be like to predict their neighbor's plans when the neighbor is doing everything possible to conceal or lie about them. That's the world of intelligence unknown unknowns. The vacation prediction exercise suggests why getting good intelligence is so much harder than it looks. Intelligence is vast and varied. The U.S. intelligence community is vast, comprising 18 federal agencies and roughly 100,000 people that do everything from identifying strange gases in suspect buildings to eavesdropping on terrorists to compiling information for the president's daily brief each morning. A Washington Post investigation found that in 2010, 33 building complexes for top-secret intelligence work had been built in the Washington, D.C. area since 9/11, with a total square footage equivalent to nearly three pentagons. At these and other secure locations, intelligence analysts churned out 50,000 intelligence reports a year. For 2021, the total intelligence budget was an estimated $85 billion. To put that number into perspective, it's more than the gross domestic product of half the countries in the world. U.S. intelligence, in a word, is big. Intelligence is also varied. Major intelligence agencies specialize in disciplines called INTs. The National Security Agency collects Foreign Signals Intelligence, or SIGINT, which includes telephone calls, text messages, and email. The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency collects and processes satellite imagery and other intelligence from space, known as GEOINT. The Defense Intelligence Agency collects human intelligence, or HUMINT, sometimes overtly, through defense attachés posted abroad, and sometimes clandestinely. The CIA is the nation's premier clandestine HUMINT collector, with case officers recruiting and running foreign assets, aka spies. Many believe that publicly available information, or open source intelligence, OSINT, has become so important in the internet age that it needs its own agency. The point is that intelligence is highly specialized. Just like doctors, intelligence officials develop expertise in different areas. Nobody wants their dermatologist performing heart surgery or their heart surgeon detecting skin cancer. Intelligence is no different. If you've ever tried to judge whether a satellite image is showing a railroad line or a highway, or whether the coding quirks behind a cyber attack indicate a particular culprit, you'll appreciate how much specialized intelligence expertise matters. American intelligence is outward-looking. Many countries' intelligence services spy on their own citizens. In 2018, China spent more on internal security than external defense. Russian domestic surveillance and political repression have such a long history. The country celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Soviet secret police in 2017. During the Cold War, domestic spying operations became so large, the Soviet Union spy agency, the KGB, established a special directorate to handle them. American intelligence, by contrast, sharply distinguishes between foreign and domestic targets. Almost all American intelligence is aimed abroad, at foreign allies and adversaries. Only one of the 18 intelligence agencies has domestic intelligence collection as a core mission, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is housed within the Department of Justice and operates with extensive legal and policy constraints, judicial review, and congressional oversight to protect American rights. The National Security Act of 1947 explicitly prohibits the CIA from exercising any police, subpoena, law enforcement powers, or internal security functions. That's not to say there aren't violations. The NSA, CIA, and FBI were all found to have spied illegally on American citizens in the 20th century. NSA's Shamrock program intercepted American communications from the end of World War II until 1975. The FBI spied on, infiltrated, and disrupted political dissident groups from the 1950s to the 1970s, a program Congress found to be far beyond the bounds of what was tolerable in a democratic society. The CIA's HT Lingual program illegally opened hundreds of thousands of letters to and from U.S. citizens during the same period. All of these activities violated American law. But that's the point. Domestic law forbids this kind of surveillance on Americans. U.S. intelligence agencies were set up to protect the nation from external threats, not to maintain internal political control. That's what intelligence is. It's equally important to know what intelligence isn't. Misperceptions abound. We tackle three big ones involving secrets, the news, and the relationship between intelligence and policy. Most intelligence is not secrets. Contrary to popular belief, secrets in intelligence are rare. Intercepted phone calls, stolen documents, and firsthand reports by spies are always important. But since the Cold War's end, it is estimated that more than 80% of information in a typical intelligence report is not secrets. It's publicly available information, what intelligence officials call open source intelligence, or OSINT for short. OSINT includes a wide range of information and sources, everything from routine bureaucratic documents published by obscure foreign government agencies, to televised speeches by foreign leaders, to maps available on Google Earth, and ISIS decapitation videos posted online. As we'll discuss more in Chapter 9, OSINT is growing dramatically. Online connectivity, artificial intelligence tools, the proliferation of small commercial satellites, and other technologies are giving ordinary citizens, non-state actors, and foreign governments more information and more analytic capacity than ever before. There is both promise and peril in this OSINT revolution. New technologies offer intelligence agencies more potential information and analytic tools, but they are also leveling the intelligence playing field and making open democratic societies more vulnerable. To give just one example, President Trump's Twitter feed became an open-source intelligence goldmine for foreign actors, providing a steady stream of information about the president's opinions on matters from the frivolous, whether he liked the latest Saturday Night Live episode, to the consequential, whether the Secretary of State should negotiate with North Korea. The tweets conveyed what Trump thought, felt, and prioritized, what actions or words elicited different responses from him, and whose opinion he valued. It's believed about half of Trump's tweets came directly from him. The U.S. intelligence community can only dream of having that kind of insight into the thinking of leaders in authoritarian regimes that censor the internet and tightly restrict the flow of information, like China's Xi Jinping or North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Intelligence is not Google or CNN. All intelligence is information, but not all information is intelligence. If the United States intelligence community only stated the obvious or passed along the same news stories as CNN or the Wall Street Journal, it wouldn't add much value, especially for the estimated $85 billion per year it costs. Today, with so much more information online and more real-time information at decision makers' fingertips, it's worth asking what makes intelligence valuable. First, intelligence tailors information to a policymaker's needs. Intelligence agencies don't just spit out the same responses to everyone like Google searches. They answer specific and often highly classified informational demands of customers like the tank commander, the diplomat, the national security advisor, and the president. And they have to be timely, delivering information when policymakers need it, before a missile launches or a summit convenes or the National Security Council makes a decision. When you're doing negotiations, knowing as much as you can about what the other side is thinking is very useful, said Michael McFaul, who served as ambassador to Russia in the Obama administration. We have some tremendous capabilities. There's just no replacing that. Continuous interaction between policymakers and the intelligence community is essential. When you are in continuous conversation, noted former National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, policymakers can clarify what you need to know and work hard on collection and analysis that fills gaps, reveals weaknesses, and advances policy. Sometimes serving policymakers' needs means telling them what they don't want to hear or never thought to ask. This is known as speaking truth to power, and it's a core part of the intelligence mission. As former Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats put it, we strive to know the truth, and we have an obligation to speak the truth. Anything short of that is a disservice to policymakers and to our country. Coats did just that in 2019, when he delivered the intelligence community's annual threat briefing to Congress, which offered a different assessment of threats than President Trump, including a far more pessimistic assessment of prospects for North Korean denuclearization. In authoritarian regimes, intelligence services often tell leaders what they want to hear. In the United States, intelligence agencies strive to tell leaders what they need to know, a role that can lead to friction, as I discuss more. The second way intelligence adds unique value to policymakers is by turning information into insight. Raw data isn't worth much without analysis. These days, we are swimming in data. Some estimate the total amount of information in the world is doubling every 24 months. Much of it is wrong, incomplete, misleading, contradictory, poorly sourced, poorly argued, even deliberately deceptive. To this seeming chaos, intelligence analysis brings logical reasoning skills, assessing the credibility of information and what it means. The goal isn't to predict the future with 100% certainty. Nobody can do that. It's to reduce uncertainty about present conditions and what possible futures could unfold. Analysts wield hypotheses, not crystal balls, asking what explanations could possibly account for the information they have. Analytic tradecraft seeks to uncover broader patterns and reveal cause and effect relationships that help anticipate where events are likely to head and why. Analysts do this by synthesizing open source information and secrets. Even though secrets constitute a small percentage of most intelligence reports, those classified nuggets can be priceless. In the hunt for bin Laden, one key breakthrough came in 2010 when the National Security Agency intercepted a telephone call from bin Laden's former courier to a friend, suggesting the courier might be back in the game working with bin Laden. By putting this together with other secrets and open source information, analysts eventually found the courier, tracked him to Abbottabad, and planned the operation that killed the Al-Qaeda leader. It's worth noting that intelligence analysis also drives intelligence collection, surfacing what crucial information is missing that needs to be gathered. Intelligence analysis is often described as connecting the dots, but that's only half right. Good analysis suggests what dots should be collected, too. Intelligence is not policymaking. One of the most common misperceptions is that intelligence agencies make policy. they don't, and they shouldn't. Former CIA Director George Tenet experienced this misperception during a 2007 Daily Show interview with comedian Jon Stewart. Tenet was promoting his memoir, but at the time anger over the Iraq War was running high, and Stewart was pulling no punches as he questioned Tenet about the Iraqi WMD intelligence failure and the decisions that led to war. But Stewart did not understand the role of intelligence. He kept pushing Tenet about Bush administration policy choices. Would Tenet fire Vice President Dick Cheney if he could? Did Tenet give intelligence to the White House to help sell the war to the American people? Did the United States go to war with Iraq because some in the administration wanted war more than Tenet and Secretary of State Colin Powell? As Stewart fired away, Tenet grew visibly frustrated. Intelligence and policymaking is a contact sport, he explained, but the boundaries matter. John, it's important for you to understand that when you're the director of Central Intelligence, you don't make policy. Your job is to give people data. When you start crossing those lines, then your analysis becomes suspect. The intelligence policy divide was news for Stewart and his viewers. Intelligence agencies were never designed to be just another set of policy advisors. Their job is to present the available intelligence, not make the case for policy A or B. In fact, intelligence officials are trained to not make policy recommendations, even when asked. As former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper wrote, the number one unwritten rule of intelligence is leave the policymaking to the policymakers. If intelligence officials weigh in on policy debates, Clapper noted, they risk compromising their credibility as impartial, unbiased bearers of intelligence truth. He made a strict practice of staying out of policy discussions during National Security Council meetings, so much so that once he waited until after a meeting was over to tell President Obama a personal anecdote about his time serving in Vietnam, out of worry his story might have swayed the discussion had he mentioned it during the meeting. Intelligence leaders have not always hewed to this rigid boundary, but they cross it at their peril. Even in the best of circumstances, tension between policymakers and intelligence officials is inevitable. Because intelligence success is hard, and mistakes are so costly, policymakers are right to be skeptical about the intelligence assessments they receive. Friction also arises because policymakers and intelligence officials come from different worlds and serve different roles. Policymakers are natural optimists. Presidents, after all, campaign on promises to build a better future. Intelligence officials, by contrast, are natural skeptics. There's an old joke that when an intelligence officer smells flowers, she looks for a coffin. Policymakers are political appointees with short time horizons. Intelligence officials are career appointees with long time horizons. For policymakers, the imperative is getting things done. For intelligence officials, the imperative is getting things right. In every administration, intelligence officers must walk a fine line between responsiveness and independence. They have to gain the president's trust without sacrificing credibility and support the nation's elected leader while relaying information he may not like or want to hear. Susan Gordon, the nation's number two intelligence official from 2017 to 2019, noted, "Every president wishes intelligence could say things that it can't, and every president is vexed by intelligence because we steal their decision space." Little wonder all presidents have issues with the intelligence agencies that bring them news of unwelcome surprises, tell them how their favorite policies may backfire, and caution that they are unable to predict the future with telepathic accuracy. President Kennedy so distrusted CIA Director John McCone, he ignored McCone's warnings about the Soviet military buildup in Cuba in 1962 until it was nearly too late. President Richard Nixon nursed deep suspicions of the Central Intelligence Agency, questioning the agency's loyalty as well as its competence. "What the hell do those clowns do out there in Langley?" he once asked. he ended up firing CIA Director Richard Helms in 1972. President Bill Clinton's relationship with his CIA director, James Woolsey, was so bad that when a small plane crash-landed on the White House lawn in 1994, aides joked that it was Woolsey trying to get a meeting with the president. At first, that kind of stung, Woolsey later reflected. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, what the hell? That's really exactly what the situation is. As former CIA director and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates put it, few presidents have anything good to say about the CIA or the intelligence they received. President Trump's relationship with his intelligence agencies was especially turbulent and public, raising concerns about the potential for lasting damage to intelligence capabilities, credibility, and morale. Trump called intelligence officers Nazis and tweeted that his intelligence chiefs should go back to school after they publicly contradicted his claims about Iran, North Korea, and ISIS in congressional testimony. When Director of National Intelligence Daniel Coats stepped down in August of 2019, Trump nominated a congressional loyalist with no significant intelligence experience to replace him, and ominously tweeted that America's intelligence agencies needed to be reined in, by which it appears he meant that they should start agreeing with him more, regardless of what the facts said. The nominee, John Ratcliffe, withdrew under fire when news surfaced he had lied on his resume, but he was renominated a few months later and confirmed by a party-line vote. Trump's hostility toward the intelligence community prompted unprecedented reactions from former intelligence officials. Former CIA and NSA director Michael Hayden wrote in the New York Times in April 2018, "We in the intelligence world have dealt with obstinate and argumentative presidents through the years, but we have never served a president for whom ground truth really doesn't matter." Former CIA Director John Brennan was especially acerbic, criticizing Trump in deeply personal terms. He called Trump a national disgrace, characterized Trump's acceptance of Putin's denials of election interference as nothing short of treasonous, and suggested that Trump's venality, moral turpitude, and political corruption would relegate him to a disgraced demagogue in the dustbin of history. Nobody knows what the long-term effects of this hyper-political moment will be for U.S. intelligence agencies. A human lens, life in the intelligence community. Intelligence also has a human dimension that's rarely seen. Who works in this secret world and why? How do they deal with secrecy in their daily lives? How do they think about ethics? What are their toughest and proudest moments? I put these questions to nearly 24 current and former intelligence officers and examined the memoirs of others. Here are glimpses into their world. Who works in intelligence and why? Bill Phillips was an African-American progressive student and activist in law school in the 1970s when he noticed two men who seemed out of place at a career fair. They weren't students and didn't look like lawyers. Phillips was president of the Student Bar Association at the time. He decided he should ask who they were. The answer was CIA recruiters. "You're at the wrong law school," Phillips told them. "Our school is known for being involved in activist law, like women's rights and civil rights. You need to go down the road to that other more traditional law school." The recruiter said they'd stay anyway. And by the way, what was his name? It was a spot interview. Phillips assured them he had no interest in joining the CIA. A few years later, Phillips received a letter in an unmarked envelope with vague instructions about a job interview in suburban Northern Virginia. Thinking the agency wanted to hire him in the general counsel's office, he went. But the interview was for the clandestine service. "Look at me. I've got this big afro. I've been a student activist in the 1960s. I said, you really don't want me. They said, yes, we do." It turns out Phillips had spent part of his childhood in Pakistan and had familiarity with languages, studying German and Amharic and picking up a little Urdu before college. He ended up jettisoning his legal career and spent the next 25 years as a CIA case officer, recruiting foreign spies, conducting counter-narcotics operations, preparing the groundwork for an invasion, and leading the agency's offices in several countries. But he never told his mother he worked at the CIA until his retirement ceremony. "I didn't think my parents would actually understand why I left my career as a budding lawyer to become a spy," Phillips told me. Michael Morell had never traveled overseas. He'd hardly left Ohio. When it came time for college, he stayed close to home, attending the University of Akron. An economics whiz, he planned on getting his doctorate and going into academia. He still seems like a professor, with wire-rimmed glasses and a careful way of thinking through any question. He applied to the CIA on a lark when one of his professors suggested it. Morell would eventually serve as President George W. Bush's daily briefer, run the CIA's analytic branch, and help lead the hunt for bin Laden. Former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper grew up in military intelligence. His father was an Army Signals Intelligence officer. Clapper enlisted as a Marine Corps reservist and eventually became a 3-star Air Force general. But he started his signals intelligence career at the age of 12, using toothpicks and his grandparents' television set to intercept communications of the Philadelphia Police Department and tracking their activities, codes, and call signs on a homemade database of index cards. Gina Bennett is one of the world's leading terrorism analysts. In 1993, she wrote the first intelligence assessment warning that Osama bin Laden was a rising terrorist threat. She's also a mother of 5 kids who once went into labor while briefing National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. Bennett started her career as a State Department clerk typist because it was the first paying job she could get. "I'm still a really fast typist today," she told me. Her boss quickly realized that Gina's talents extended far beyond fast typing, promoted her, and told her to get a job in intelligence. Robert Baer spent his childhood getting into trouble, skipping school, dreaming of becoming a professional skier, and roaming across Europe with his adventure-seeking mother. "I managed to make it through Georgetown, but not by much," Baer wrote. His pranks included rappelling off the Kennedy Center during a performance and infamously riding his motorcycle through the Georgetown Library during exam week, where he was spotted by a classmate named George Tenet. Baer became a decorated CIA case officer who spent 2 decades running agents in the Middle East. Tenet worked on the Senate Intelligence Committee staff, the National Security Council staff, and eventually became CIA director. When the two ran into each other years later at a White House meeting, Tenet told Baer, "This is the last place I ever thought I'd run into you." As these vignettes suggest, intelligence officers are an eclectic bunch. If you were asked to pick one out in a room full of people, you'd probably get it wrong. The workforce has come a long way since the 1950s, when it was mostly white, male, and plucked from Ivy League campuses. Intelligence officers are so varied in part because intelligence agencies are too. Each of the intelligence community's 18 agencies has a unique role and a culture that comes with it. NSA, for example, employs legions of mathematicians because its mission involves intercepting foreign communications, code-making, and code-breaking. As former NSA senior official Bill Nolte put it, NSA is not an intelligence organization. It's a cryptologic agency. Each agency has subcultures, too. The CIA combines 2 vastly different worlds. The agency's human intelligence collectors, or case officers, tend to be risk-takers with exceptional interpersonal skills who enjoy running toward the sound of gunfire, working in dangerous places, manipulating foreigners, evading surveillance, and gathering information in secret. As Phillips put it, they're the fighter jocks of the agency, the pointy end of the spear. The agency's analysts couldn't be more different. They tend to have exceptional intellectual skills and enjoy solving vexing puzzles, working in cubicles, developing hypotheses, challenging assumptions and sources, and finding insight from disparate pieces of information. John McLaughlin headed the CIA's analytic branch and is widely admired as one of the agency's best analysts. His hobby isn't motorcycles, it's magic. A world-class amateur magician, McLaughlin's nickname around the intelligence community is Merlin. Why do intelligence officers serve? When I asked Bill Phillips why a black activist from the 1960s would give up a legal career to join the CIA, he didn't hesitate. "Because every male in my family on both sides has been a U.S. service member. Every male. My father was a World War II Navy vet. Both of his brothers were Korea vets. Both of my mother's brothers were in the Army in Korea. My brother was a naval officer. All of us had this thing in us about service to America." One former official was drawn to the NSA because you stand on the front lines of protecting the country. Michael Morrell says he often thinks about something a defense official once told him. "When you go home, would you rather tell your family you sold more trucks than anybody else in the world, or you stopped a terrorist attack?" The mission is a powerful draw for linguists, mathematicians, terrorism analysts, daredevils, and civil rights activists alike. Daily life in a secret world. Gina Bennett tracks terrorists around the globe, but the CIA makes it hard to keep tabs on her own children. Not because of the long hours or the sudden crises, it's the phones. For security reasons, cell phones aren't allowed inside the building, and office phone numbers change frequently. What's more, whenever CIA employees take on a new role, they change desks. And whenever they change desks, they have to get a different telephone number. In one assignment, Bennett moved desks 4 times in the span of a few months, and her children couldn't remember her work telephone number. "I teach my kids not to answer a call they don't know, so my kids wouldn't answer when I called them," she said. Working in the intelligence community is not a normal job. Secrecy and security touch every part of daily life in ways most people cannot imagine. It's hard to get medical test results without a regular office telephone number. Intelligence officers spend a lot of time in parking lots because that's the best place to check the news on social media. Resumes have to be officially approved each time they are updated. Kids are often taught to be wary, looking for anything that might be out of place. Years ago, Bennett's son got worried. He'd been working at a coffee shop, and a pretty girl kept coming in. Eventually, she asked him out, and he learned she was from Afghanistan. "She's completely out of my league," he told his mother. "I think she's trying to get to you through me." Security investigated and found nothing amiss. "Your son probably just has a confidence problem," they told Bennett. Intelligence officers can't reveal much to their families about what they do. There's no spousal privilege for sharing classified information. The day of the bin Laden raid, Michael Morrell missed his daughter's final high school choral performance. His wife was furious. "Whatever you're doing can't be that important," she told him. All he could do was apologize. When President Obama announced the raid on national television later that night, she knew what had kept him at the office. Intelligence officers operating undercover may not even be able to tell their families where they really work. Most others have much more discretion. The CIA lets officers decide whether and when to tell their kids the truth. The agency also hosts an annual family day when kids can try on disguises, see polygraph machines, and play with disappearing ink. Bennett told her oldest son when he was 5, after she took him to the office one weekend, and he started asking questions about all the posters of terrorist events on the walls. She explained her job was sending tips to police about where to find bad guys. "Wow, you're like Batman," he said. Bill Phillips revealed that both he and his wife worked at the CIA when his oldest son was 11 and they were living in a South Asian country. "Terrorism was in full bloom," explained Phillips. "He wanted the kids to know not the details, but who their parents worked for. They might hear things in school that might be ugly. they should ignore them and tell Daddy and Mommy if they heard something. In another foreign country, after he received a vague death threat to his family, Phillips taught his children how to be safe on the streets. "I wanted them to be able to detect when things were not normal. We'd play a game. See the guy with the balloon cart down the street? Was he there yesterday? What's he have on?" His older son remembered thinking it was cool that his parents worked in intelligence. Not everyone reacts so well. Former CIA counterterrorism chief James Olson recounted how one CIA friend revealed the truth to a daughter. She slammed the door to her room and cried for hours. Unfortunately, this sense of betrayal is not uncommon among CIA children when they find out the truth, noted Olson. Spouses and children sometimes know without ever being told. Aris Pappas was a lead CIA military analyst on Poland during the Cold War, when Poland was ground zero for any military conflict involving the Soviet Union. One of his most valuable sources was a Polish colonel named Ryszard Kuklinski, who narrowly escaped capture and execution when his cover was blown. The CIA exfiltrated him and resettled him in the United States. Kuklinski and Pappas worked closely together and became friends. Pappas never told his family who he was, but they all knew. "Here I was, a 30-something-year-old analyst, and suddenly I've developed a friendship with a 50-year-old Polish guy. And my wife was reading about this Polish colonel in the U.S. My wife never had a briefing. She didn't need one," said Pappas. "My kids knew it was serious and that he was not to be spoken of, ever. They called Kuklinski George. As Pappas put it, George was a friend. George came to dinner. George went on boats. And nobody talked about George." Ethical dilemmas. If you ask intelligence officers what misperceptions bother them most, odds are they'll mention ethics. "People think we're lawbreakers, we're human rights violators," said former CIA counterintelligence chief James Olson, who wrote a book about intelligence ethics. When Gina Bennett first offered to teach a Georgetown University course on intelligence ethics, one of her future academic colleagues asked, "Are there ethics in intelligence?" Actually, intelligence officers think about ethics a lot because they operate in a profession filled with ethical dilemmas, where the trade-offs are complicated, often agonizing. The NSA did not cavalierly decide to collect telephone call records of millions of Americans after the September 11th terrorist attacks. As I discuss more in Chapter 8, intelligence officials and policymakers carefully considered the program. They sought and received presidential approval. They got legal guidance, and they vigorously debated the ethical dimensions of a massive new intelligence collection program targeting the data of Americans. One official resigned in protest, later noting, "It was the wrong thing to do for the right reasons." Ethical dilemmas don't just involve high-profile, high-stakes programs. They're part of everyday life. How do intelligence officers weigh action versus inaction? Keep a collection stream going or capitalize on the information it provides and lose the source forever? How far should they go to speak truth to power when speaking out may lead policymakers to shut out intelligence altogether? Where does loyalty to the president end? Where do they draw their own moral lines, regardless of how many legal memos say an action is constitutional? "We take upholding the Constitution very seriously," said Bennett, "especially those of us who have been overseas and have seen governments who would just as soon kill somebody as let them speak. Those discussions really can get very deep, and we have them a lot." One former NSA official recounted being asked to recruit a foreign emigre he knew. Recruiting human assets was far outside his normal job, which was analyzing signals intelligence like emails and intercepted telephone calls. The manipulation made him deeply uncomfortable. "I'm making friends with this guy so I can exploit him," he said. When the emigre asked to have dinner with their wives, it was too much. "He was a nice guy," said the official. "I had to go to my handlers and say, we're done." Bill Phillips faced the opposite ethical problem. what to do when a junior CIA case officer suddenly has qualms about recruiting a spy in a foreign country, which is exactly what case officers are hired to do. If you don't manipulate people, you won't be successful at recruitment, said Phillips. You have to have the mental acumen to do it without hesitation. Second-guessing in the field wasn't just ineffective, it was dangerous. Phillips sent the junior case officer home. These are good questions, heavy and thoughtful questions, he advised. You should have a way of resolving these questions in your mind, but it's not going to be here. Ethical dilemmas abound. In his book, Fair Play, Olson lists 50 scenarios taken from the real world of espionage and covert action that U.S. intelligence practitioners currently face or could conceivably face in the future. Among them, a foreign asset violates human rights or requests payment in the form of prostitutes or drugs. An asset working to penetrate a foreign terrorist organization seeks approval for a terrorist attack to prove his bona fides. A former CIA officer defects to an enemy, leading to the deaths of other CIA officers and assets, and you have to decide whether to try to kidnap him. An opportunity arises to create an anti-American terrorist chat room, but it may identify American citizens who are radicalizing. Intelligence officers grapple with these and other ethical dilemmas in different ways. Many told me their ethical guide is imagining what the American public would think if the secret became public. As one put it, would I be proud to tell the American people that we did that? That's exactly how CIA Director Leon Panetta presented the Bin Laden raid to President Obama. If I asked the average person, if you knew what I knew, what would you do? Panetta asked. In this case, I think the answer is clear. If we don't do it, we'll regret it. Regardless of the outcome, the decisions linger. As one official put it, ethical questions will put scars on your soul that you can never get rid of. Best and worst moments. For CIA analyst Aris Pappas, a highlight of his career came one day when he walked into a Virginia safe house and met the Polish agent whose intelligence he'd been using for years, a man who had risked everything to help the United States. It dawned on me, oh my God, this is the agent, this is the source, he said. Dan Coats' best day as Director of National Intelligence came on his one-year anniversary in the job. Morale was low. Coats was under attack. The intelligence community was being pilloried by the president. Coats invited anyone who wished to take the constitutional oath of office with him online. Hundreds did, from agencies across the intelligence community. No matter what happens, he reflected, we have to be faithful to that oath. For Susan Gordon, who spent more than 30 years in the intelligence community and served as the number two intelligence official, the best and worst days were the same. Meeting the coffins of intelligence officers killed in the line of duty abroad. I thought I should finish these patriots' trip home, she told me. Gordon would go to Dover Air Force Base, often alone, in the middle of the night, to be with the families of the fallen. God, the families were always young, she recalled. It was awful. They were racked with pain. They'd have their babies, their little girls, 6, 4, and 2, in tow. In some cases, Gordon was the one who had sent the intelligence officers on the assignments that got them killed. And always, in the middle of me comforting these families, they comforted me, she said, choking up. They said, he wanted to be there. Don't worry. This is what he chose. The grace shown to me on their worst day was my best day, said Gordon. I carry those men and their families with me. This is the human side of intelligence. An operational lens of intelligence in action, the hunt for Bin Laden. For intelligence officials, 9/11 was personal. A sign hanging above the entrance to the CIA's counterterrorism center sent a daily reminder of the price of failure and the importance of the mission. Today's date is September 12, 2001. They would end up hunting the Al-Qaeda leader for a decade. Although much remains shrouded in secrecy, information released to date offers a valuable glimpse into the workings of intelligence collection, analysis, and covert operations that led to one of the greatest intelligence successes in American history. Finding Signals in the Noise, Intelligence Collection. The hunt for bin Laden started with a botched raid in the mountains of Tora Bora. Soon after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, CIA officers, U.S. Special Forces, and Afghan militia fighters had Al-Qaeda on the run, chasing bin Laden and about 100 of his men to a maze of tunnels and caves high in the icy peaks of the Hindu Kush. By December 2001, Allied forces were closing in. With bombs pummeling Tora Bora from above, bin Laden wrote his last will and testament, telling his wives not to remarry. Gary Bernstein, the CIA officer leading the team, thought he had him. But for reasons that are still unclear, the raid went sideways. In the dark hours of night, bin Laden handed his satellite phone, which he suspected was being tracked by the CIA, to an aide and slipped away. Days stretched into weeks, then years. The working theory was that bin Laden was holed up somewhere in the lawless mountain passes along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. But the terrain was punishing, and the trail grew cold. It was certainly not for lack of trying. Intelligence agencies went into collection overdrive, using all of the ints. Experts mined open-source information, including 24 audio and videotapes issued by bin Laden, assessing whether the voice was really his, and examining details, like the background images or whether he was holding a weapon by his left or right side, that might suggest his location or his health. The CIA even enlisted the help of geologists and botanists to examine foliage and rock formations in the videos that might give clues to bin Laden's whereabouts. The National Security Agency kept its ears trained on terrorist communications, hoping to intercept signals intelligence that could lead to bin Laden. But with 1.7 billion phone calls, emails, radio signals, tweets, and text messages intercepted every day, it was akin to finding a needle in an enormous and ever-growing haystack. And in any case, Al-Qaeda's leader and his trusted lieutenants had ditched their cell phones and satellite phones so their conversations wouldn't be intercepted. After Tora Bora, they abandoned cell phones, sat phones, and the internet, resorting to a small circle of trusted couriers who hand-carried communications to his network and released the occasional video and audio messages. President Bush directed the CIA to flood the zone with human intelligence collectors. CIA officers poured into Afghanistan and Pakistan in the hopes of recruiting a foreign asset who might know where bin Laden was hiding. U.S. airplanes dropped flyers with bin Laden's face behind bars and offered a $25 million reward for anyone who helped turn him in. Other terrorists were captured, detained in CIA black sites, and subjected to harsh and controversial interrogations to learn more about Al-Qaeda's operations and bin Laden's whereabouts. CIA Director Leon Panetta later noted that some of the information detainees provided was valuable, while some of it was intentionally false or misleading. Unmanned aerial vehicles flew the skies over Afghanistan and Pakistan, surveilling, hunting, and striking. In the end, there wasn't one aha moment or lucky break. For years, there were only fragments and whispers, potential clues surrounded by false leads and dead ends, painstakingly collected, dissected, and resurrected. In 2002, a detainee not in CIA custody provided the nom de guerre of a bin Laden courier, Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti. While analysts knew that targeting bin Laden's courier network was important, it would take years before anyone learned the courier's true name or location. But evidence increasingly suggested he was a promising lead. CIA records show that by 2007, more than 20 detainees had discussed al-Kuwaiti's ties to senior al-Qaeda leaders, including his role as bin Laden's courier and his close relationship with al-Qaeda's third-in-command, Abu Faraj al-Libi. Other information came from what detainees did not say. When interrogators ran al-Kuwaiti's name by Abu Faraj al-Libi, he denied ever knowing him. Another senior al-Qaeda leader in custody, KSM, or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, downplayed the courier's importance, leading intelligence officials to suspect that both terrorists were trying to conceal just how important al-Kuwaiti was. The coup de grace, wrote former CIA Deputy Director Michael Morell, was when KSM returned to his cell after the questioning and communicated to other prisoners that they should not mention anything about the courier. Our interest in the courier was now sky high. Somehow, intelligence officials have never revealed the details. In 2007, they learned the courier's real name and later discovered the general area where he operated. In 2010, the National Security Agency intercepted a phone call he made to a friend. "I'm back with the people I was with before," said the courier, indicating he could be working with bin Laden or another high-level al-Qaeda figure again. Eventually, intelligence officers identified the courier's white Suzuki and tracked it to the Abbottabad compound. For the next several months, agencies inside the intelligence community collected every piece of information they could about the compound and who lived there, without tipping them off. The National Reconnaissance Office sent satellites to capture images of the pacer taking his walks. The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency used reference points from the images to estimate his height, as well as the genders and heights of others living there. The NGA used other sensing devices to create 3D models of the compound. The CIA's Open Source Center scooped up public information about the city of Abbottabad, but to keep operational security tight, officials requested research on several Pakistani cities. The CIA also set up a safe house in Abbottabad with a small team to establish patterns of life at the compound. Their activities included spying on the laundry hanging outside to determine the number of residents, their genders, and whether they were adults or children. All of this does indeed sound like something out of a Jason Bourne film. And because we know how the story ends, success seems inevitable. But it's important to bear in mind that the intelligence community never got conclusive evidence that bin Laden was hiding there. His tradecraft was too good, the task was too hard, the timing was too tight, and the risks of discovery, which could blow the best chance to get bin Laden since Tora Bora, were too high. Many collection efforts were considered but never tried. Others failed or were thwarted by countermeasures. CIA Director Leon Panetta kept pressing for more creative ideas, asking whether sewers could be tapped to collect DNA from the waste or whether surveillance cameras could be placed on the trees just outside the compound. As Panetta himself recounts, it was a good thing CIA veterans shot down that idea, since the trees were trimmed not long after, and any cameras would likely have been discovered. The CIA's most ambitious plan to confirm bin Laden's identity involved a phony local vaccination program. The aim was to get DNA samples from people inside the compound that could be compared with bin Laden family member DNA on file at the CIA. But the scheme failed, and the Pakistani doctor leading it was arrested and sentenced to 33 years in prison. To thwart NSA surveillance, the terrorists never called from the compound itself, instead traveling an hour and a half away before even putting a battery in a cell phone. "You gotta give him credit for his tradecraft," said one former CIA official involved in the manhunt. 10 years earlier, bin Laden had bodyguards, multiple SUVs, and things like that. He abandoned all of that, which made him harder to find. When President Obama made his go-no-go decision on the SEAL team raid, estimates that the pacer was actually bin Laden ranged from 40 to 95%. even with the full might of the $85 billion intelligence enterprise, nobody could be certain that he was there. Challenging intelligence analysis. Analyzing intelligence in the hunt for bin Laden was just as challenging as collecting it. Analysts had to deal with two major questions. The first was, what should we be looking for? The second was, what does our intelligence mean, and how credible do we think it is? While the courier network ultimately led to success, it wasn't the only path. Analysts looked at multiple possibilities and took a systematic approach to locating him. One focused on bin Laden's sprawling family. He was known to have 4 wives and about 20 children. And the chance that a relative might contact the Al-Qaeda leader, eventually leading officials to his location. The CIA succeeded in identifying one of bin Laden's sons and learning that he had been under house arrest in Iran. But by then, the son, Saad bin Laden, had been released and left Iran, so the agency had to track him all over again. By the time they located his whereabouts in Pakistan, he was dead. CIA analysts also sought to identify signatures of bin Laden's lifestyle that could help track him down, like the medicines he might need for chronic health problems, his hobbies, and how he liked to move or live. According to Panetta and his CIA chief of staff, Jeremy Bash, the questions for the bin Laden manhunt focused on how and where he would be hiding, including what security he would be using. The working hypothesis, they later wrote, was that he was located in the tribal areas in western Pakistan, probably in a cave or a rural area, separated from his family. The hypothesis was that well-armed guards surrounded him. There was also a suggestion that his health was failing and that he may have been hooked up to a makeshift kidney dialysis machine. Almost everything about that working hypothesis turned out to be wrong. Bin Laden's compound wasn't in some remote mountain cave. It was in a suburban neighborhood in a city of about 1 million residents. Abbottabad wasn't even known as a stronghold for Islamic extremists. When analysts considered likely locations for bin Laden, Abbottabad wouldn't be on that list, said one former intelligence official involved in the manhunt. Bin Laden also wasn't separated from his family, as analysts expected. He was living with them, 3 wives and 12 of his children and grandchildren. Nor was he surrounded by well-armed sentries and layers of security. Instead, he lived with chickens, goats, rabbits, and the families of 2 trusted couriers who had a handful of weapons. His hideout didn't have any booby traps or escape tunnels. His security depended on staying off the grid while living in the middle of the grid, hiding in plain sight. The SEALs didn't find a dialysis machine inside the Abbottabad compound either, but they did find hair dye for men. For the Abbottabad lead to be right, the analytic team hunting bin Laden had to be willing to challenge their prevailing hypotheses. That's a very hard thing to do. As I'll discuss more in Chapter 5, psychology research has long shown that humans are highly susceptible to confirmation bias, trusting more in information that confirms their prior beliefs and discounting information that doesn't. There were many good reasons to believe that bin Laden was camped out in a fortified rural stronghold like Tora Bora, hidden by the rugged terrain, protected by his followers, and disconnected from the rest of the world. After all, he had done it before, and it was well known that bin Laden enjoyed rural life and that he was intimately familiar with the ravines, paths, and caves of the area, having fought the Soviets there in the 1980s. Admitting that the hypotheses guiding the 10-year hunt for the world's most wanted terrorists could be wrong was a heavy analytic lift and a major breakthrough. Panetta and Bash write that agency analysts were willing to admit that the agency had been wrong, and they were willing to dedicate finite resources to an entirely new theory, one that upended all previous assumptions, and to imagine that bin Laden's plan to hide in plain sight was more brilliant than we had ever guessed he'd be. Bin Laden's hiding strategy deviated completely from what he had done before, and it was likely an unexpected change, even for him. It was an unknown unknown. Then there was the problem of assessing the significance of the intelligence that came in. Detainees were known to lie and distract, sending interrogators on wild goose chases. Sometimes they provided truthful information, but often they didn't. Pulling intelligence threads led to both dead ends and renewed hopes. At one point, for example, the CIA heard the courier they were tracking had been killed in Afghanistan, but it turned out to be his brother. Among the most vexing challenges was that the same facts could support different theories. The pacer could be bin Laden, that's what everyone hoped, but he might also be another al-Qaeda figure, or a warlord, or a drug runner, or nobody of interest at all. To make sure wishful thinking wasn't clouding the analysis, the National Counterterrorism Center assigned a red team of fresh analysts to review the intelligence, scrub all of the assumptions, and play devil's advocate, challenging everything. They did not reach a consensus. The president's advisors didn't agree either. When Obama asked how likely it was that the pacer was bin Laden, the lead analyst put the odds at 95%. Several others answered between 60 and 80%. Michael Morell, the deputy CIA director, told the president he was more certain that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction than he was that bin Laden was in that compound. Michael Leiter, the head of the National Counterterrorism Center, was even more pessimistic. He put the probability at 40%, though he noted that's 38% better than we have ever had before. It was a stunning range of answers based on the exact same information. People don't have differences because they have different intel, the CIA's Morell later explained. We are all looking at the same things. Instead, Morell concluded the variations stem from experiences. Counterterrorism specialists were optimistic because they were coming off a string of recent successes in locating and killing top terrorist targets. But Morell and others who had lived through the intelligence failures of 9/11 and Iraq WMD were far more cautious. Even if we had a human source inside the compound, and that source told us that bin Laden was there, I would not be at 95%, Morell recalls telling the president, because sources lie and get things wrong all the time. Former CIA Deputy Director John McLaughlin also believed the Iraqi WMD failure played a large role. In a curious and ironic way, he told me, the bin Laden estimate may have been right because of the Iraq failure, the caution it planted, and the sensitivity to rigorous analytic tradecraft. Still, all that watching, collecting, analyzing, scrubbing, and red teaming could only reduce uncertainty, not eliminate it. By April 2011, the intelligence was as good as it was ever going to get. The president had to decide. Covert action. Covert action, as we'll see in Chapter 7, is reserved for the toughest situations. It involves activities intended to influence political, economic, or military conditions abroad, where it is intended that the role of the United States government will not be apparent or acknowledged publicly. Covert operations are led by the CIA. All presidents use them because they offer a third option between doing nothing and going to war. But precisely because they are tools of last resort in difficult circumstances, covert operations have a high rate of failure. Confronted with intelligence about the pacer, President Obama considered four options. Each had serious drawbacks. A large airstrike would obliterate the compound, but would be an overt military action against a sovereign partner that could ignite a political and potentially kinetic firestorm. It was also estimated to cause 50 to 100 deaths and would provide no proof that bin Laden had been killed. A drone strike with a small missile could hit the pacer during his walk and avoid other casualties, but the munition was experimental and could not be guided after launch. If it missed, bin Laden would vanish again. If it hit, U.S. officials would not be able to confirm bin Laden had been killed or retrieve any intelligence from the compound. waiting for more intelligence might confirm the Pacer's identity, but increase the risks of a leak tipping off the Pakistanis or bin Laden. A covert special forces operation deep inside Pakistani territory risked the lives of 24 men, could ignite a shooting war with a putative ally, might not get bin Laden, could kill innocents, and could fail, triggering a domestic political crisis akin to President Carter's after the failed Iranian hostage rescue mission of 1980. But a raid offered the best chance of confirming bin Laden's identity, retrieving intelligence, and providing potential deniability, however thin, if bin Laden wasn't there. 2 days later, under a moonless sky, choppers carrying American commandos secretly flew over the Pakistani border. 15,000 feet overhead, an RQ-170 stealthy drone beamed real-time footage to command centers at the CIA, White House, and Pentagon. President Obama and his senior advisors huddled in a cramped room as CIA Director Leon Panetta narrated the unfolding operation. The tension of the moment was captured in an iconic White House photograph. "They've reached the target," said Panetta. Then things went south fast. The first chopper was forced to crash land. A second was supposed to hover over the compound's roof, but had to jettison that plan when the other one crashed, so it landed across the street instead. This meant that instead of assaulting the compound from above and below simultaneously to maintain surprise and speed, SEALs had to work their way slowly through the house, clearing rooms as they moved up to the third floor, where they believed bin Laden was living. All the noise woke neighbors who started approaching the compound to see what was going on. Minutes passed. Shots were fired. Officials said it felt like years. Eternity is defined as the time between when you see something go awry and that first voice report, said one special operations officer. Then the news. "We have a visual on Geronimo," said Panetta. And finally, Geronimo EKIA, enemy killed in action. In the Situation Room, it was silent. Then Obama said, "We got him."